From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Robert Arellano is the founding director of the Center for Emerging Media and Digital Arts at Southern Oregon University. Thank you, Robert, for being on the Oregon Grapevine.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Barbara.
There are some complicated and easy ways, I'm sure, to explain and elucidate on the art and the work that you create. So I'd like to just start with an easy version. And what does that center do, and how does it affect all of us?
Southern Oregon University brought me here, we're going on 16 years ago now, in 2010. A real visionary dean, my dear still friend and mentor, Alyssa Arp at the time, wanted an interdisciplinary center that would bridge across computer science, art, what we had at the time as a sort of a video production program, as well as literary arts. And so what I do, what I have been doing for over 30 years now, is at the intersection of those. I like to say the easy explanation for the emerging media program at SOU is digital storytelling. We tell stories in all kinds of platforms, and not only digital, but in interactive platforms in the real world as well.
That includes, if you were going to read, let's say, e-literature, you're going to read a book that's, or a piece that you all have created. It's not just words. It's pictures. It's lots of things. Is it links to other places? Can you explain a little in an aural way how it works?
Yeah. I like to start with, especially because we're coming up on a significant anniversary for me, and I think for American literature in digital format, Web 1.0, 30 years ago this summer, I wrote the first web novel. It actually was born 5 years earlier in the great American postmodern novelist Robert Coover's workshop at Brown in 1991. And it was the first ever master's thesis, MFA, in creative writing submitted at the, I guess at that time, 230-year-old university's grad school. It's called Sunshine 69, and it's still online. You can read it right now. And this summer, I'm going to be doing a series of online and real world events to acknowledge the anniversary. And it's images, it's sound, but it is mostly words. That was something I picked up from Robert Coover. Keep the prose, the primacy of the prose, he used to say, in the foreground. And so we would think of it at the time as something like interactive storytelling that we know well from Wikipedia, but in this case, fiction and imaginative, sometimes surrealist literary experiences.
There has been talk over decades and years, and in fact, I used to work at a library in my past, that books and reading was going away. And obviously, there are still books and there is still reading, but there's also this other, it's expanded beyond the book that you hold in your hands. So you are around all kinds of people, students, adults, sometimes that's the same, students and adults. What is your perspective, or what do you hear from people about that conversation?
Wow, over the waves of decades now, I thought that some of Coover's early New York Times book review cover stories, like the one that was not with his permission, titled by the editors, The End of Books, in, I think, the summer of 1993. That has not come to pass, fortunately. And in fact, I'm also the author of 6 novels in print. I still prefer, for my own reading experience, a good old-fashioned print-bound book. But what I think I, in the most recent wave, have been happy to see, the Gen Z students in my classes now love interactive storytelling as an adjunct to their book reading and to their other surfing online. They call it interactive fiction. They use platforms that we think of as maybe more fanfic focused. So some of them in my currently advanced digital narrative course are writing stories that are based in video games, but then bring those out into the literary world. They keep teaching me new things. So it's cool that between, I think, what's been two or three generations overlapping since I was a student, it's as strong as ever. And people are telling stories on a new and innovative media all the time.
This is tangential, but I imagine is also affects your work and what's going on. AI is a specter that is everywhere, and it has to do with kind of everything we can think about in terms of taking away jobs, in terms of writing, in terms of creativity. How does it work in your world in terms of the conversation about AI? Are people embracing it and using it? Are they freaked out about it, or all of those things?
I really want to answer on behalf of my students for this one, because I think I was a little readier to allow a bit in, as you know, as early as a year and a half or two ago, when all of us were maybe experimenting for the first time with that free version. I've always chosen not to make an account with OpenAI, for instance, but they told me, and I have graphic design students as well as writing students, that they wanted me to keep it out of the classroom. And I'm glad they did, because I think there's something I'm realizing as an artist and a creator, not so much for the audiences, but for the creative spirit, the person doing the work. You can't just let a little bit in. You crack the door, and it's like that scene from Close Encounters. You get blasted by the both the seductive echo chamber of the incessant affirmation of the chatbot. But you also get drunk on the artificiality that at the same time seems so seductive of the images. And not just images, but we know deepfake videos and being able to simulate sounds and voices and type something in and have 500 different characters try to do the reading. So I'm all for staving off the you shall be assimilated moment as long as possible.
Students and people who are in and studying emerging technologies, one footnote is to say, tell me some of the, kind of what is an emerging technology? And from that, what are people doing with that major and with that study? Where is it going professionally? It's not everyone, I'm imagining, just writing novels.
So true, Barbara. I'm glad you asked, because this is that time of year when the folks across Oregon and other parts of the PNW all over are trying to decide what college to go to. And I still think we're a differentiator at SOU, partly because of in 2010, we chose that word emerging. And it wasn't just me, it was a team of great faculty from all those departments I mentioned earlier. And we realized it was because the process was still being written. We weren't going to know. People were using terms like new media, multimedia, digital media, of course, at the time. But we thought emerging represented it best. At the time, it encompassed mostly those things we think of as the three stools of graphic design, the three legs of the stool, graphic design, and a little bit of interactive storytelling, my own digital narrative work, and the beginning of game dev and animation and motion graphics. Now it includes UX, UI, right? The app prototyping that students are doing in our foundation level classes. It includes VR, where students are able to create immersive worlds using assets borrowed from Steam. In like 10 weeks, one student can create something that looks like Fortnite or Red Dead Redemption 2. It's incredible. But we still keep the storytelling in the foreground. We say, look, you know, you can have all of the flashy bells and whistles that you want, but this is going to emerge on the basis of the voices that still have a sort of integrity, literary, journalistic. We have sound design certificate now, where students do several levels of beginning and intermediate podcast and radio production. And thanks to the fact that we've got JPR, our NPR affiliate, Jefferson Public Radio here on campus, our students get internships in radio still. And that's great, because we know now that radio is as much about the streaming later as it is about playing over the airwaves now.
And I'm just going to back up for a second. You use the word VR. That's virtual reality, correct? I'm just
kind
of
right.
Okay. Just throwing that and out there as an acronym.
And I'm glad you did, because it also allows me to say AR, augmented reality, where we think of the famous example from some years back of Pokemon Go, allowing us to look at our phones and see things that are in a collective VR world that has been transposed upon our actual visual material world. And that's VR, virtual reality, AR, augmented reality.
You brought up gaming in terms of people creating them or people using them to tell stories. How is that world? Is it all kind of an overall huge umbrella? There's gaming, there's esports, there's emerging technology, there's some of which is, of course, beyond someone of my age to totally understand experientially. But I'm curious how that all relates and goes into the future together.
Yes, and by the way, I'm a fellow traveler in that if it weren't my full-time job, I don't know how I would keep up. I don't. I was just telling my students yesterday that in our best workshops, and I think they really are peer-to-peer teaching each other more than I could ever teach them alone as their coach, it's more a cross-country, and not an endurance, but more just a warm-up long run than it is a sprint. And so we carry each other along sometimes and wait up and don't get too far ahead. One of the characteristics that I find most attractive for the students is that they're still gaming tabletop RPGs. And I learned that acronym from them, role-playing games. They're playing Dungeons and Dragons. They're playing board games. And they have a sometimes fluid movement, sort of code switching between the digital and the material world. And that's really exciting for me, is that they're more comfortable doing that and being able to recognize that there's both online gaming and real world play, and that how important both of those things are interwoven with each other in the experience they have interpersonally and with other members of their family. We recently taught a course called Intergenerational Game Space about people playing between generations of family and or community. And it's exciting. They really are leading the way and showing me how to try to stay at least up to date, if not relevant, in my own work.
I'm just laughing at a thought that's crossing my mind, which is the classic old story of someone coming home and saying, "Mom, I'm studying philosophy." And the parents just kind of looking at them like, what are you ever going to do with a philosophy degree? To some degree, I can imagine there's a similar generational gap between a person coming home and saying, "I'm studying emerging media." And they're looking at them like, what is that?
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I want to circle back, and it really is now getting straight to the heart of the matter. The jobs out there, and I believe that the parent generation who I meet sometimes only on the last day, right? You know your students for 4 years, and then the parents come to commencement, and you finally get a chance to say, "Hey, thanks for trusting your student to us for those years." They more than ever are seeing, and it started to happen when we would teach app prototyping and the student would go home on a break or show their family visiting a fully working example of their original idea for a mobile app on their phone. And the parents said, "You're learning this, and it involves graphic design, it involves interactive experience, UX, UI, and it involves often innovative ideas about business and or philanthropic potential for emerging media." And that, as well as other examples we're seeing now, students are getting hired to create short streaming Instagram reels for local and regional businesses, because social media strategy and social media storytelling, terms that I prefer to say being an influencer or a creator, but they're adjacent, are actual needs that I think some of the larger public relations and marketing advertising agencies haven't picked up on as nimbly as the freelance and or small company student organizations have.
This field of academia that is emerging media that SOU is to some degree leading the way on, are there other schools or other institutions that you find are also doing it in creative ways that you have conversations with?
Yes, and in fact, this week I'll be celebrating with my friends at Washington State University, Vancouver, the 15th anniversary of their electronic literature lab. They call it the ELL, or the ELIT lab for short, where they've been both preserving and archiving the history now, that's over 30 years old, of emerging media, and talking about what's next. funny that it happens to be also in our region, but I think one of the most significant spots in the country. My own alma mater, Brown University, is also creating an electronic research repository through their university libraries that's actually integrated with the 200 and something year old libraries at the school. And that's great that there's digital archiving that's also taking into account innovation and ways that we will continue to do scholarship moving forward. And sometimes there's an outlier that just blows me away. I happen to know a professor in Boulder, Colorado, who's got a PhD program, and it's a mouthful, called Intermedia Art Writing and Performance. He calls it IAWP for short. And there's people who are doctors of this now. So good programs in every time zone, if you will.
How did you, from studying with Robert Coover, and I'm imagining, although he was not exactly traditional, I happen to be, oddly enough, a fan of his, from more traditional books to realizing, wait a second, I want to do this. This intrigues me and inspires me.
And I say that as kind of two minds, because Coover never himself published anything on these platforms. And I was taking note of that. I was his teaching assistant. And then when he went on sabbatical, I became junior faculty and spent 10 years on the faculty at Brown after the 6 years as an undergrad and then grad student. After that time, and myself writing 6 conventional novels, I still go back to the print-bound novel, as I mentioned. I want to give you a good example from the Oregon history that, for me, has got an incredible richness in our variety of novelistic innovation and experimentation. And I think that's what Robert Coover always thought, and why he wanted to be a teacher, if not a practitioner, is that it was a place for innovation. It was a place to create new kinds of stories, and therefore new relationships between the author and reader. And that was what originally attracted me and got me to write Sunshine 69, is that excitement of how I was giving the reader a choice, or thousands of possible choices. Sunshine 69 is about 300 chapters of a variety of lengths. Some just a sentence long, some you have to scroll for a while before you get to the bottom. And yet between those 300 passages, there's over 5,000 different links that create thereby hundreds of millions, I would think, reading possibilities. That's what attracted me. But just for instance, 10 years ago or so, I realized that the 50th anniversary of Ken Kesey's Sometimes a Great Notion was coming up. And I taught that in a just good old English class. And we discussed how the nonlinear experimentation of stream of consciousness and the way Kesey would swap voices in the middle of a phrase sometimes was its own form of literary experimentation in print. I think of Ursula K. Le Guin, and I think of all the great rich Oregon history of imaginative experimentation in sci-fi literature. And that still goes hand in hand. They're being woven together, the history of digital literatures and print canon of contemporary American letters.
A piece of your life and culture that we have not touched on here, but I know is related to your writing and the work you do, is the fact that you're a first generation Cuban, if I'm not mistaken, Cuban American.
Yeah.
And wondering how that experience, staying away from perhaps the political moment, but more the literature moment, how that is affecting kind of your perspective and what you write and how do you bring that into the world? I mean, obviously, it's hard to say to someone, who is this? How would it be different if you weren't? I'm not asking that question, but I'm asking you how does it work for you?
I'm so glad we didn't leave that in the side view mirror too far, because I've been to Cuba. I almost lost count, but I know it's at least 23 visits since 1992. So I'm realizing, wow, you know, the 35th anniversary of my first trip is coming up next year, and I'll probably go back again. My first few trips, because it was where not only my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, but my brothers and sisters are all, we're the last of 5 siblings from Cuba. And yet, before I was born, the family left. And so I felt like I was returning to my own patria, my own motherland, for the first time on that trip. And I was so inspired. I just, was pen in hand all the time. Didn't have a laptop, of course, yet. And 7 or 8 trips sometimes twice a year throughout the 90s, left me with reams of raw material that I finally then turned into a novel that was nominated for the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Allan Poe Award in 2010, Havana Lunar. That's a double entendre. It's written in English, but lunar both means lunar, and you know, like the, of the moon in Spanish, and it can stand for a beauty mark or a birthmark. And so that's a kind of a crux to this Cuban noir, as my publisher, Akashic Books out of Brooklyn, helped me market it. and I wrote a second sort of standalone sequel to that novel called Havana Libre, also peppered with some Spanglish here and there, but an English language novel that I'm pretty proud of. Both of them have been turned into audiobooks. One of them by Blackstone Audio right here in Ashland. We love that we've got the world's largest independent audiobook producer, right? There's Goliath, Audible, and then there's everyone else. And one of the largest of the last 5% is Blackstone. Those books for me really embody my somewhat fictionalized, but love for and experience with heritage from Cuba. And I recommend them to anyone. I'm glad they're still in print and also have good audio and ebook formats. Check out the free sample on either Blackstone or Audible's website, because the voice actor, Jonathan Davis, who's won a number of Audie Awards, does a fantastic job code switching into the various dialects of Cuban and Cuban American Spanglish that I use in the novel.
What inspires you to do this work and do your kind of life's journey this way?
You know, I think I am being more inspired than ever by a fire not to let what the world is kind of keeping me a little, as I think it is all of us, discouraged about, also keep me from preserving and perpetuating what's exciting and essential about storytelling among humans. I would be remiss not to mention that SOU, my home institution, is in a real crisis right now. It's in the news, everyone can look it up. It's the real-time dismantling of a college that's really the only four-year university for 150 miles in any direction, as far as I can tell. And there's a lot of folks, my friends and neighbors here in Ashland, Phoenix, Talent, Medford, are going to lose their livelihoods. And this process of them inviting me here and asking me 15 years ago, 16 years ago, to start this interdisciplinary center that I'm still keeping going with some good friends, I've got to perpetuate what it is that only we, I think, know how to do as, and I would happily call myself a mid-career artist and educator. That's something that I'm not finished building yet. And so in order to sort of rage against the doging of higher ed, every day I think I get energy from the students on saying, you know, you'll carry this forward. And someday folks will say, you are the OGs, the original gangsters of the emerging media creativity world that was hopefully going to be with us for generations to come.
Oregon Grapevine is OG. That's how I refer to it. So
I love it. I was thinking the same thing in my shorthand.
Now you know my little secret side conversation.
Yeah, yeah. You are OG.
My sons will be happy to hear that.
Yep.
Anything you want to add here, Robert, that we haven't? I mean, there's obviously deep places we can go, but just kind of in general, something people should know about this field of not making it quite so scary. Can other people touch into it? How does that, what do we do?
You know, I mean, shout out to the Miller Foundation. And what you say, who are the Miller Foundation? I think it was partly their, it's the James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation's 3-year commitment, which we are right now square in the middle of, to support emerging, or excuse me, mid-career artists with their Spark Award. That was, you know, a monetary award, but also connected me with a cohort of 19 other Oregonians. This year, the theme was literary and interdisciplinary arts. That has re-energized me. And I wanted to bring it up because the first year was musicians and composers. That was 24. And then announced right at the end of 25, and I met all my fellow cohort members in December, was the literary and interdisciplinary. Next year is visual art. Lots of great information on Miller Foundation's website. And that's that. It's kind of like this place, Oregon, for whatever reason, I think has the best support of any arts community, not just in the PNW, but, you know, in the universe right now, with the NEA being dismantled and other national NEH having, you know, so much polarized, what would seem like ideological cancellation happening at the level, at the program level. People, for using one word that doesn't look right to an internet search, can find out that their funding was revoked or even clawed back. And then for the Miller Foundation to step in with an award that frankly is even richer than I think the NEA's annual arts grants, and to give it specifically to Oregonians who are keeping this kind of work going, really, really speaks a lot to why I feel like we're here at the right place at the right time, and with the legacy of you know, Ms. Le Guin and Mr. Kesey and filmmakers like Kelly Reichert and friends and colleagues like Nisha Burton, who I know was on the OG some weeks back. We're going to keep this flame of telling the stories of the regular of Oregonians alive.
Thank you so much, Robert Arellano, for being on the Oregon Grapevine, for doing the work you're doing and giving me and the listeners a little insight into this world of emerging media.
Barbara, thank you so much for keeping these stories going. And OG, I'm down with OG.
The secret's out, I guess.
Yeah, it is. Let's just call it by its name.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.